Your data is like gold to hackers, and they'll sell it to the highest bidder. Are you protected? McAfee helps shield you, blocking suspicious texts, malicious emails, and fraudulent websites. McAfee Secure VPN lets you browse safely, and its AI-powered tech scam detector spots threats instantly. You'll also get up to $2 million of award-winning antivirus and identity theft protection, all for just $39.99 for your first year. Visit McAfee.com. Cancel anytime. Terms apply.
Welcome to the Breakpoint Recap Show. I'm Gil Gross with Alex Gruskin. We have broken down all five episodes in depth of the new Netflix tennis docuseries, Breakpoint. We have also interviewed Taylor Fritz, the current world number five. And now we bring on someone who would probably be in the world's top five in showrunning and producing. He is the executive producer and showrunner, co-creator of Billions, and he is an expert on television. So we've had Taylor Fritz. Now we are bringing on Brian Koppelman, who, by the way, is not just a TV guy. He's a tennis guy, a tennis purist. And we're going to talk to him about what did and what didn't work in Breakpoint. You know, I'm just going to say it right now in the intro, Gruskin. Brian had a lot of critiques for what we saw in the first five episodes of Breakpoint.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You mentioned he's a showrunner. I think first and foremost, he would want to be known as a tennis fan. He talks about how it's been a passion of his through the duration of his life. And as such, you hear his passion for the sport throughout the course of today's interview. And, you know, I think he really wants this show to work. And that's why he is so adamant about, I don't want to say the approach he would have taken in differentiating himself from the approach they did take, but again, talking about what makes a show like this compelling, what, in his opinion, you have to be targeting. We talk a lot about that target audience throughout the course of today's interview. I appreciate his candidness. I thought it was a fantastic interview.
Me too, and I 100% agree with you. Mm-hmm. If he didn't care deeply about the sport, there's no way he would be on with us being as honest as he was about some of his disappointments in the show. I think that's 100% correct. So without further ado, here is Brian Koppelman. Pleasure to be joined by co-creator, showrunner, and executive producer for Showtime's Billions, and he also co-directed one of the best tennis documentaries that I've ever seen. It's titled, This Is What They Want, an ESPN 30 for 30 on Jimmy Connors and his 1991 US Open run. And Brian, I want to start there because 30 for 30s famously give the creators a lot of freedom on what they want to do. And you can correct me if I'm wrong,
yes. But
as far as I know, Bill Simmons kind of comes up to you and says, what do you want to do a doc on? And you get to decide. Why did you choose to 100%. Do the U.S. Open?
Well, first, it's great to be here. You know, I'm a tennis fanatic. I think you left that part out. I'm sure maybe in the intro before I got here, but which is part of the answer to the question. And yes, Bill's amazing. You know, we've been friends. My creative partner David Levine and I have been friends with him for 20 years, maybe a little bit more than 20 years now, and when we were texting about the notion of doing a 30 for 30, and Dave and I were about to take off on an airplane, and we looked at each other, and I just texted Simmons and I said, Connor's 91 open, and he immediately wrote back in, and that was really it that got us started. Then landing Jimmy was hard, you know, because Jimmy knows who he is, and he knows the kind of angle of attack people might take in wanting to document who he is and who he was. And, but I was sure that we would do something that he would know was fair, in the end. And that was the sort of communicating that to him, finding people who were friends with him, who knew us and who he would trust, who were able to say to him, you know, you won't have any creative control or input, but if you cooperate, you will be treated fairly. You will be represented accurately by people who understand who you were and understand why you mattered so much and what you did for the game of tennis. Because what could get lost in his antics is that he was really part of the reason that tennis was an essential part of the culture in the 70s and 80s. And we did understand that. We showed it. And look, I grew up working at the US Open. So that's when you're, you know, it's incredibly personal. Dave and I grew up together, and he didn't work at the Open, but he certainly came and hung out with me there. And that was like the best job I ever had. Like if I had a normal job, basically for anybody except me now, that would be the best job they ever had. Like I get to do this incredible thing for a living, but in a way, like, you know, getting to work there back then. And I can't remember if we talked about this at all last time I was on the pod, but you know, I think I graduated high school 84. So I think I worked there the 3 years like that summer. And then like the summer before senior year, junior year and 10th grade, those three summers. And at that time, if you had a badge that got you in, you and you would show up early enough, you could hit on all the outer courts. And you could also hit on the grandstand. You know, at that time, it was the grandstand was the, there was no Billie Jean King, right? It was Ash and then the grandstand. And you could, I mean, it was Louis Armstrong was the main thing. There wasn't even an Ash. It was Louis Armstrong and then the grandstand. Those were the two feature courts, really. And I hit on both of those. You could kind of like, you would get to kind of know the security guys. They would look the other way. If they saw you there every day, you'd get the, you know, you'd be setting up the week before or 4 or 5 days before, you'd be in there setting up for your booth. And then we got to just watch all these matches and got to sneak into the players' locker rooms. And there was no security. It was like way before the world became so security conscious. And so if you were 16 years old and you had some rackets in your hands and, you know, you were goofily dressed in like some Alesse because that's what you were selling. I mean, you just could just kind of wander around. So I had this incredible connection to the players of that era and to that tournament in particular. I mean, I would be there from an hour or two before the gates opened. And most days I stayed until the very last match was over that night. And, you know, that's an intense time, 15, 16, 17 years old. And obviously I'd like, played tennis my whole life. And so I was tennis camps and it was a culture that I just cared a lot about.
Well, I ball boyed in 2013 and 2014 at the US Open, grew up in Westchester, New York, which is in some ways kind of similar to Long Island, a suburb of New York City. And I can tell you, I didn't manage to hit on any of the courts. So I was, I was a little late to that.
They shut you,
unfortunately.
Yeah, they shut you guys. There's no chance, right?
So that's incredible. That's an awesome experience. But Brian, as someone in TV, which went on to be your real career because you didn't continue to work at the US Open forever.
Could have been a chair umpire.
You're in the business of building good characters, right? It is what you are incredible at. So now you watch Breakpoint. They don't have the luxury of creating the characters from scratch because they're real people. But I'm curious from your perspective as an expert on characters, which characters do you think in those first five episodes, which ones worked and maybe which ones didn't work as well?
Well, I would, because they're real people, I don't want to, let's step back. Let's just step back and look at it a little bit from 30,000 feet because I don't know how the two of you feel about it. And I would love to have a conversation about it. Even more than just being interviewed here, because I'm trying to figure out why I found the thing not so compelling. And I think, I wonder if, like, I understand the reasons it's good for the sport. Like, I can understand what's sort of what's really useful about it to all of us who love tennis. And, you know, I'm someone who still play 4 days a week when I can. I would play 5 days a week if I could. A week that I played 3 days or two, I feel like I haven't really, you know, my game's just like not improving. It's just staying there. And if I play once a week, I feel like I'm just rapidly declining. So, but I found myself incredibly distanced from all the characters. Like I did not feel that the show did a really, and I'm trying to understand if it has to do with being such a close viewer of tennis for such a long time, or if it has to do with the media training that these athletes have had. And even, you know, in the Berrettini episode where the two of them, you should feel something about this journey that they're on. And they just, you know, there's one line in it about the selfishness of tennis players, but that's the only kind of, like, you know, peek into it. And then they, for me, can I just ask, I haven't heard the pods you've done about this yet. So how do the two of you feel about the show? How did it hit you both as such close observers and participants in the game?
I think you nailed it in the sense that we are all trapped within the tennis bubble. So there are certain developments to us that are less relevant or even dated within the show. For instance, they frame Casper Ruud as a rising player. Well, if you follow the game closely, in January 2023, he's not a rising player. He's a two-time slam finalist, a world number two. We know who Casper Ruud is. I do think, and I do want to have this conversation from that 30,000-foot view. You talked about the Jimmy Connors documentary you did and the idea of showing his flaws but remaining fair. I think, first and foremost, that's what struck me as disappointing about this show. And I'm curious if you felt this way. It was very conflict-averse. And I just wonder, dating back to your experience, how difficult it must be to go to a Taylor Fritz or go to, obviously, the elephant in the room, Nick Kyrgios, and say, hey, we want to talk about your flaws because we want to make you a compelling character. That's what attracts, I think, everyone to shows like this, is seeing the flaws, seeing how they rise above.
It's not just the flaw. Like, yes, drama needs conflict. Like, for you to want to watch something, there has to be conflict in it. That's if I'm creating something with Dave that's a fictional construct, or if you're making a documentary, the documentaries that are most compelling, even when they're hagiographic in a certain way. Like, if you look at When We Were Kings, which clearly celebrates Ali in this incredible way, man, every second of that thing, there's conflict, not just because it's a boxing match at the end of it, but George Foreman's journey there. Ali's journey, each step along the way involves some sort of conflict. And look, what we all know about the world of tennis is, like, there's conflict in these motherfuckers walking out the locker room before they're interviewed. Like, who steps where? Everyone's pissed off. You know my superstitions or whatever. And you took two right foot steps. You f***ed me up. Or she wouldn't talk to me and turned her back while I was doing. I mean, there's opportunities for conflict just are constant. And they avoided that. Also, they were unable to create drama. It was amazing to me the choices. And look, making documentaries is really hard. I don't ever slam fellow filmmakers. Like, they did a lot of things right. And that's what I'm trying to understand. Like, meaning, you know, I was trying to understand if you're a novice to the game or if you're someone who used to kind of follow tennis, but you don't really know it, but they made certain choices. Like, the way, even in their match coverage, they would kind of jump sets, or they would not, and then for a knowledgeable tennis fan, they tried to create drama where people are, like, on serve or something, and they try to make it like somebody's losing. And it's like, no, they're not losing, dude. It's 3-4. Like, nobody's winning and nobody's losing. Mm-hmm. And so that made me wonder if maybe the biggest problem is when they were having their meetings, they were not clear about who the audience was, because it's not really set up like that. They didn't do the thing where they explain to the person who's a neophyte, here's how a 5-set match works, here's what matters, here's what, when you have to win by, like, they didn't, there's all sorts of work they didn't do to lay out how tennis works. So then, okay, you're marketing this to, you're making this for people who are pretty savvy about tennis. Well, then, if you're making it for people who are savvy about tennis, you can't sort of try to fuck with the way we watch tennis. You can't try to falsely create these moments of drama within the matches that aren't there. Also, like, tennis fans know who won Indian Wells. We know what was at stake in Indian Wells. We were all talking to each other online and when we like during Indian Wells. So there were just, you know, sort of for me, it never, I can't fathom being bored. You know, I'm someone who can watch, I can watch Tennis Channel for a long time. I can watch tennis TikToks. I mean, what I wanted was a separate track where Craig Shapiro was talking about the matches, though. You know, that's what I wanted. And this was so sanitized and boring that, and I can't, if I'm bored in watching something about tennis, it's a really, I think, a bad sign.
Yeah. So I think where we're at a disadvantage as tennis people is we are not going to learn as much. Did you watch the golf one, Full Swing, at all?
I started and I'm pretty like checked out on golf too. Okay. But here's why I'm not sure that's true. Like in there are plenty of things that we know a lot about. Like if because of these other events, like if I watch a thing on poker, like if I watch a cutaway during a poker tournament to the story of Antonio and Phil or, whatever the cutaway is going to be to, I'm still like pretty engaged. And obviously like I'm in a very small group of the most knowledgeable people about that because I've studied it so closely for so long. What did you think? Like watching the golf one. Yeah, that was good. What were your thoughts?
I think because we live this, you need to strip down the access to a level where things feel new to us. And I think the golf one does a little bit better with that, where, oh, we're in Brooks Koepka's house. This is what his house looks like. He's hanging out with his wife and you're a fly on the wall, right? And there's also more conflict in the golf because of the live thing. They got lucky in that. And did they shy away from it? No, they leaned into it. It was a main topic. So you have conflict. You have more access. You're on Ian Poulter's private jet. We were on Nick Kyrgios's private jet, but other than that, we weren't with players when they were traveling from tournament to tournament, which is a huge part of what they do on tour. So I think for us, it's harder to teach us stuff. The way you can remedy that is with extreme access, stripping down those walls. I didn't feel like that really happened.
I agree. And I think like, you know, people have, I mean, if you look at the Arthur Ashe documentary, now granted his life really allowed for it, but you watch that documentary and you're really invested. I've read like you guys, I've read the McPhee, like I've read all about the biggest moments in Ashe's life. Every article that was ever written about him when I was like, I know everything about that guy. And still that documentary, I sat down and I could not take my eyes off it. I found it so compelling. And they found stuff like I really didn't know about his college years. I didn't know that he and Kareem were at college at the same time. There were fascinating things about that. Here, yeah, and maybe the golf, you know, it's weird. The golfers, partially because of the pro-ams, I think, like the way golfers interact, they're always marketing very, the golfers know that they have to reveal parts of who they are. And maybe it's the way people are golf fans in America, like golf is has a bigger impact. And so these people are more famous and more used to engaging in those ways. Like Rory has to be somebody who talks about who he is. He just does it all the time. Same with Spieth, same with a big list of those dudes. They do that, you know. I mean, even this year, one of the Cordas, the one who played with the guys, you know, she went out with she talked about, hey, I wish there was something talking about the fact that I'm good for a woman. I loved playing with him. Like she was willing to just totally talk in a way that tennis players rarely do. Like, you know, I mean, if you get a tennis player for 2 minutes talking privately, they'll start talking about Tiafoe's forehand and how it's like holding him back and why he needs to rebuild it and all this stuff. And there was none of that. Like, nobody, there was no sort of
No, it's interesting, and I apologize for interrupting. It's interesting to hear you say that, because I think – I want to talk about one moment that worked, because I'd be fascinated to hear your thoughts. It was – you know, again, we talked about episode 5 and something that worked so well, the Nadal warm-up and watching him in the hallway, right? I can still hear the music, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he's going side to side, and he's in Casper Ruud's space, and he's in Felix's space, and you can feel, you know – him suffocating them. That was conflict. That was showing tennis at its finest. It's how do you capture, in my opinion, more moments like that? Because, and this is the question I wanted to ask you, I think it might be pretty hard to show tennis in this medium, in the sense that a good tennis point, it's probably 72 seconds. And like, are you really going to give up 72 seconds of a 43-minute episode showing one point? I'm curious how you would go about showing that tennis, showing the physicality, because I think that's something this lacked, and I'm not sure how to best do it.
Well, I learned that this, Dave, and I learned this in making the Connors documentary, because the most famous point where Jimmy returns all the overheads.
Of course.
I forget the guy's name, the tall guy. It's Harhus, right? Is it Harhus?
Paul Harhus. Shout out Florida State.
So he's playing up Paul Harhus, right? So originally when we cut that, we did not show the whole point. We cut away and then came back. And we showed it to a friend of ours, the director, Steven Soderbergh, who's a legend. And he said, I need to see that whole, you're talking about this point. I know why your instinct is to cut away. Just try, go in your editing room and just try. What would it look like if you played, you did all the time, and then you just played that point? So we got to understand it fully. And in fact, I think that 72 seconds that you're talking about, if you could set that 72 seconds up properly, and then on the back end talk about it, the reward of that would be enormous for the viewer to understand. But okay, let's dive into this Nadal thing. So if I were going to do a documentary about Nadal that included Nadal, there's no way to do it without asking him about his rituals in a non-casual way. So when he would say, well, it's just something I do, I would want to be like, okay, talk about how you pour your orange juice in the morning. Like, does that do your compulsions? Talk about what it makes you feel, why you have to do those things. And then I would talk to other players. Hey, when Nadal's doing that stuff, what does it make you feel like? The fact that he gets more time, the fact that everybody accounts for it, the fact that he's able to allow his superstitions to take up this much time and everyone else has to lock down their superstitions into that much time. And yeah, maybe 5 or 6 people would go, he's the greatest of all time. Whatever he has to do, it's good for the game. But you'd find some person who would go, that. And now you get one who says that, you go back to Nadal and you go, I don't know what to tell you, but the number 174 player just said, you know, you have OCD and it shouldn't be accommodated for. You should have to go take some meds. And like, you know, now we're really in it. But they weren't going to do any of that, right?
Well, so the reason to follow up, Nadal didn't agree to be in the show. Like, Djokovic wasn't a part of the show. And I do worry, like, is Taylor – so it's – you know, I love Taylor Fritz. He was kind enough to come on the show. He gave an interview about his participation. But like, to get back to this theme, like, Taylor Fritz has a son who I believe is 6 years old. Like, they didn't talk about him. It's like, are you saving that for season 2? Like, what are we doing there? It's just – and if you feel like, again, in terms of breeding rivalries, right? Like, Nadal was the elephant in the room that everyone was chasing. At Indian Wells, we know he's in the finals, but they don't talk about that. Obviously, we know he's going to win the French Open. They don't really talk about that. Does it just come down to like –
they kind of skip it.
How about the Australian Open final? Or the Australian Open final, where it's like, are we going to talk about the Medvedev match? And I just wonder, like, again, you're making that choice because he's not a part of the story. Do you tell that story anyways, or do you have to exclude that?
Well, I don't know what their deals were. But again, keeping it at like, I just, again, what I really wonder is who they decided they were making the show for. And I think I would have chosen to make it really for tennis fans. Like, the advantage of making a 30 for 30 is Bill Simmons wants you to make it to get the fanatics for that thing first. You know, when we were making our first movie, we knew we needed to make a movie and write a script that the poker players were going to respond to first. Some of them may be like, there's not that much cheating, but they would understand that we were deeply inside the game and had a real point of view from people who had lived it. And you could disagree with that point of view. You could have lots of problems with, you know, on Fourth Street, someone would have played this hand differently. That's great. That's a great conversation to have. But they did not spend a lot of time, and to me, it seems, on talking about patterns in the show. Like, how do you
make
a five? Did I miss that?
Well, because no, Brian, like the example that we loved, Nadal played Berrettini. You would have thought Berrettini lost because of the mental game. It's like, no, he lost because of the backhand.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, because, well, going further, they lost because Nadal gets to his spots and he's able to impose his spots on you, and he's going to send you out far to your forehand so that then he can whip his forehand to your backhand, and like, or whatever the patterns that one guy was able to get to that the other wasn't. Basically, anyone who knows tennis at all, it's all you talk about. It's like, well, where, how do you want to set this person up? Who benefits from short points? Who benefits from long points? When do you have to decide you're going to put this much less topspin and go that much closer to the net so that you can take time away from your opponent? Who's taking the ball on the short hop? Who is not, like, right? There's all these ways. And so strategy and tactics were kind of out the window, where that stuff's fascinating. And if you explain that stuff to a regular person, like if you would say to a regular person, look, often what happens in rallies, when you're not playing against servers who completely dictate, well, at first I'd go, listen, everyone should know most service games, the expectation is you're going to hold your serve. So what this game's really about are breaks of serve. So then, you know, as a Phil storyteller, okay, what I'm waiting for are moments where there are inflection points where breaks of serve are possible. Okay, we're going to gear toward those moments. Who plays those moments better, and how do they play those moments better? And right, that's the way that sort of like goes. And so when we don't see the opportunity for that laid out here, we don't really know what we're watching for. They never really set up what's your strategy in this match? What tactics are you going to deploy to make that strategy happen? How do you study your opponent? What does that really mean? Was it interesting that their room was so messy? Totally interesting. That's a different for 1 second, right? But I don't know. So I want to understand, right? Because I go home after I play a match and I'm totally thinking about how will I beat that person next time? Or what did they do to exploit what weakness of mine? And why couldn't I, how come when I hit that serve wide and they put it to the middle of the court, I hit it 4 times in a row, I hit an inside out forehand that they got to. Well, why didn't I one time just go back down, you know, back cross court? Like, I'm living in that space and I'm watching tennis that way, as I imagine you two are watching tennis that way.
Yeah, absolutely. You're preaching to the choir. I think Gruskin and I, in terms of how we cover tennis, it's maybe 70% more inside the line stuff than a lot of other people are covering tennis. It's what we love about it as well, and how we engage with the sport. You've asked a couple of times, like, who was the target audience? I'm pretty confident. I'm pretty confident it was the casuals, because I think, and you know this about streaming services, right? Netflix saw Drive to Survive. It was a success. And then the question is, how can we do it again, right? And isn't what Drive to Survive actually did is bring in people to this sport that felt super foreign and made Americans like it?
But they did that by actually having expert point of view.
Agreed. And you learn about what it is.
That you learn about when you can pass and when you can't pass and how your teammates work. And they didn't do that. Like, I'm not sure that's to me anyway. I didn't recognize even an attempt. How do you get through a five episode thing about tennis and not really talk about break points being the most important points and setting up for break points as like the kind of difference maker in tense. What it's the whole game, the whole thing is about that. What's more important in is it taking advantage of your opponent's weaknesses or finding a way to get your opponent to play into your strengths? Do you have a 2-minute conversation with Brad Gilbert? He's going to talk about that like the whole time. Like, you know, when you're training, what's more important? Should Tiafoe spend time on his forehand trying to get it to be above average, or should he really spend so much more time on the things that are his super weapons, his backhand, his speed, his serve? Like there are all these things that the show could have, for me anyway, as a close follower and participant, focused on. And then, the other thing, like you guys are saying, is the calendar. As soon as you become any kind of tennis fan, you understand the calendar. And so you understand that Australia makes you think about the French, and the sort of lack of that conversation wasn't great. So,
I think that's fair. I would also say, looking at F1, I think something that's a little easier, and this is just team sport versus individual as it relates to tennis, is it's easier to be compelled by this team or view this team as a villain because you can paint them in a certain light without demonizing any specific individual. And the one thing I worry about with tennis is it's such an individual, you know, and personality driven sport that like it comes down to, are the characters compelling? Like, is this an individual that it makes sense and is easy to root for, root against? I'm curious if there's, and this is my last question for you, if there's any specific character right now in tennis, the obvious ones, Nadal, Djokovic, they are who they are. But is there one character in tennis right now who you find most compelling that you would want to see included in this?
Sure, I'll answer that in one sec. The other thing that the F1 show has, Drive to Survive, has is death is on the line.
Yeah,
death's on the line. So that's when death is on the line, even if they don't talk about all that, that's just, we all understand things are going 210 miles an hour.
Sure.
Death's on the line. Their emotions are heightened because when you cut somebody off, their death's on the line. And that's just not the case in our sport. So that's another sort of reason that I didn't love. That's another reason I think that for the casual fan, that maybe targeting the casual fan isn't as easy, because the adrenaline that exists in F1 doesn't exist here because of the stakes, especially like if you're not building to why these moments feel life or death, because that's the way you get around that, right? The way you get around that is, if you ever talk to a tennis player when they relive these matches in real life, they're life and death moments to them. Because they've put so much on the line. They've trained so hard. But even the way they tell Berrettini's story, you don't really get the sense that like he felt like it was life and death in that moment. Coco Gauff is the answer to that question. I'm fascinated by Coco, and I'm fascinated by, how do you say her name? Pegula? Pegula.
That's my pick.
I'm fascinated by her too, for different reasons, right? Coco, because of the expectations, the talent, and her brain. Like, she's so interesting and smart. But sometimes, as you both know, people who have the capacity for introspection that she has, it can torture them as tennis players. And so, if she can ever master the big moments, the big spots, and she's young enough, and once she does, I think it's like she could just win and win and win if she can master not double faulting in big moments. And it's so hard, right? If you're somebody whose brain thinks a lot, it's a problem, and it can be. So, but I kind of love everything about her approach to tennis. And then Pegula, because who she is, the way she grinds, and where she comes from, and the fact that she is a nation state because she's a billionaire. And she clearly has an awareness of her position in Buffalo and in America, and like does everything right on all those fronts. And she's a scrappy competitor, works her ass off. So I find her totally fascinating. I'm heartbroken that Jen Brady got the injury because she was somebody who I was so fascinated by too, because the route she took and, you know, that match was 2 years ago against Pegula was so great. Like, I really was really compelled by her. And then Rude and Rune are both really fascinating figures too. I think, and like whether they'll fully get all the way to where they can go. And then I don't know enough about them, but Ben, the college kid,
Shelton.
You guys are obviously obsessively followed for a long time. Ben Shelton, I can't wait to see what happens. Like, that's another incredible story to follow, I think.
In the next five, we know for a fact that we are getting Alcaraz. And I think that's important for the sport because this is a new star and it's time for fans to learn more about him. So I would add that. But that's a great list. Love it.
Yeah, Alcaraz is, I was watching him so closely the last 2 years, and I'm so, you know, we all knew he was going to be number one. It's great when somebody fulfills that. It's going to be great to see how many slams he's going to win, whether he can ever, you know, end up getting close to what sort of like some of these, you know, other guys have done, because he's so young, as he's, you know, same age as Pete, right? When Pete won his first. So that feels like really exciting to follow too. But he, in a way, he kind of feels like he has a great sense of who he is. And I'm interested in people as they're trying to like really get the whole way there. But it's a great time for tennis, and it's a great time for American tennis. It's like we have five guys who are good and a bunch of women who are really good. So I think it's a good time for, you know, American tennis too.
Very true. All right, let's get some of the Billions fans in here just at the end. I know the big news a couple of weeks ago is that you get to stay in the world, in the universe of Billions, because there's going to be spinoffs. Would that be an appropriate word?
There are going to be other shows within the, it seems like, within the world, universe of Billions. And then last night, it was announced from the night before that Bob Yak, Damian Lewis is coming back for this next season seven. He's gonna be in about half the season. It's been incredible to get to work with Damian again, and he's a great tennis player too, as if you saw the episode where he's hitting with Maria Sharapova. That's really Damian, nobody else. And it's gonna be great, you know, great for people to see. I can't wait for people to see it.
We can't wait as well. Thanks so much for coming on the Breakpoint Recap Show, Brian.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, fellas.